Hello, and welcome back to the Chochmat Nashim podcast. I'm Ann Gordon, here today with...
Shoshana Keats-Jaskol.
We have much to discuss today, but before we even get into the meat of it, we're going to talk today about, well, hot topics. We're going to talk about what happens to women and their jobs in the COVID pandemic. We're going to talk about women's leadership in the COVID pandemic. The COVID pandemic is really permeating our lives still. And we're going to talk about some of the issues that have come up, specifically as they connect to what we might traditionally call our Chochmat Nashim topics, or our traditional topics, at least with regard to women's experience of the pandemic. But before that, we're going to have our This Happened. And before that, we want to come back to just a point that perhaps can never be said enough, I guess, is the bottom line. Last episode, we spoke about the responsibility, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, every Jew is responsible for one another. And we spoke about it in the context of vaccination. And the fact is, we're not even getting as far as vaccination in our concern about a certain lack of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, a lack of public responsibility, common responsibility, and also, honestly, not just Yisrael Arevim. We're not just talking about Jews being responsible for one another, although that should drive the point home. We're talking about everybody being responsible for one another and the severe lack that we just keep seeing. And I would say we are all tired of the pandemic. We all want it to go away. And sadly, wanting doesn't make it so in this case. As I believe it was the head of the WHO said many months ago, just because you're done with the virus doesn't mean it's done with you.
Yeah. You said everything almost on my mind, and that is that people are sick and tired. People really want to move on with their lives, and I completely get it. But we simply can't. And as Jews, as Orthodox Jews, or wherever we find ourselves on the religious spectrum, we are used to having to do things we may not want to do. Okay? We live our lives this way regularly. And we just have to, in my opinion, understand that this is where we're at right now. That means wearing masks. It means social distancing. It means not going to massive weddings. It means listening to the guidelines of whatever country that you're in or whatever state that you're in. Please. And if your state and country have no guidelines for whatever fakakhta reason, please understand that your actions can directly affect someone else's life or death. I'd like to point out that right now in Israel, we have 10 at least women who are pregnant and in hospital from COVID. People that we thought would not get it. There's a children's ward now open for COVID in Israel. Our numbers are sky high despite our amazing vaccine drive. And it's really vital that people understand this isn't gone. And that no matter how annoying it is or how difficult it is and how much it impacts your life, please, please, please understand, in order to save lives, we really, really have to stick with all those restrictions, masks, distancing, washing hands, being careful. And I know this is hard for a lot of people, harder than it is for others, but I am begging you to please, please, please continue to try and stick by the guidelines so that we can all, God willing, be on the other side of this together soon.
I want to just also quote here, I think Rav, maybe not, Yehuda Meshi Zahav, who founded Zaka. Zaka is the organization in Israel of, it's primarily, I guess, Haredi men who go and help clean up after a terrorist attack, after any kind of death. The Zaka men are there to help escort the body and sometimes the pieces of the body to their final resting place. And they do so with sincerity and dedication and care, and they deal with death more than any of us should possibly ever have to deal with. And I mean, they are dedicated to it. And he said he pleaded with his mother to not host a Hanukkah party. So now we're talking about, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, a Hanukkah party. That's it, a Hanukkah party. And his mother hosted the Hanukkah party anyway, because COVID was over, because we had come out of a lockdown and the numbers were not really down, but let's assume they were down and vaccinations were on the horizon. So it's all over. And his mother got COVID from that party and died. And his father has died and his brother has died. And he, this Haredi man, says everybody involved in this, the rabbis who allow it, who aren't speaking forcefully against it, everybody involved has blood on their hands. This is a matter of pikuach nefesh. We all know that many, many people have contracted COVID-19, tested positive, with no symptoms whatsoever. There's so many people who didn't even know that they had it, but because they did a wide scale testing, they discovered that somebody had it. That is not always the case. And the fact that people can blow it off because some people don't have symptoms doesn't mean that nobody has symptoms. People are dying. And it sounds so melodramatic, but it's, no, it's really not the case.
Today, at least we're recording today, it's International Holocaust Memorial Day. And actually Yehuda Meshi Zahav, what his other part of his quote was, those who deny COVID are worse than Holocaust deniers. And as a grandchild of survivors, I don't have the words. And if you could see my face in the audience, I'm in tears. It's extremely emotional. But I think that what Yehuda is saying is true. If you are denying what's happening and you're actively putting people at risk, and learn from his extreme pain at losing his family members. And please, please, if you needed any inspiration to just do the right thing, please, please do.
And if we feel a little bit, and maybe we do, that we're belaboring this point, let's remember that we're not, because I don't know if any of you people listening to this podcast are the people who need to hear it. That's the biggest challenge. But maybe you know people who need to hear this message. So take it a step further, pay it forward, help everybody, protect everybody, and let's put this damn thing behind us.
Amen.
I'm also tired of it. Again, Israel's record numbers of vaccinations, and it's so exciting. And now our children are getting sick. God forbid, Shalom Nida. Okay, let's get back to the regularly scheduled program. Our regularly scheduled program begins with this happened, events of the past week. I'm going to actually begin with an event that happened today. The event is as follows. You have heard us talk about the pedophile, or the alleged pedophile, pardon me, Malka Leifer before. We have dedicated, in fact, full episodes to her, at least one full episode, and we've mentioned her in the past. Today, this very day, on January 27th, which is the date that we are recording, she landed in Australia as the final part of her extradition for the child sex abuse trial that will be happening in Australia, as it should be. She fled Australia 13 years ago. She was undergoing 6 years of trials just to get her extradited. It was never quite clear why it was taking so long. I mean, there's a lot of manipulation along
the
way.
We wrote about it.
We talked about it. And now, thank God, this chapter of this story is over. And now let justice run its course.
And the other this happened this week is quite exciting and touches on our topic today, Anne, actually. Mirav Michaeli, who is a Labor Avodah Party, MK, was actually voted in as the head of the party. And so other than the little parties who may be running for Knesset, but probably won't pass the threshold, she's currently the only female head of an Israeli political party, which is sad. But, but it's exciting in the sense that Labor is, you know, one of the oldest parties in the country. It was very responsible for a lot of things in building the country. The fact that she is a leader for women's rights and she's a very big Zionist and she cares much about the country, regardless of whether we agree with all of her politics, we wish her best of luck and are thrilled to see a female in leadership. And Anne, why are we happy to see women in leadership? What does it matter?
It's such a fine question you asked, Shoshana.
Does it matter?
I keep saying, right, we've talked about this in preparation, and I've been saying it, I think, for a long time. When we talk about women in leadership, we need to ask, is it that it happens to be that that person happens to be female and is really just the best man for the job? Is she simply just replacing?
Pardon the pun.
No, I mean it sincerely, meaning if it wouldn't have been that woman, it would have been a man, let's say, or some other woman. Is it simply just the best person and the fact that she's female is completely incidental? Mm-hmm. That's one possibility. And I'm sure that there are plenty of women in leadership positions for whom that is the case. And then I think the perhaps more interesting question is, when women are in leadership roles, do they bring something different to the table by virtue of whether it's nature or nurture? And we can go around that, you know, table for a long, long time, the nature nurture debate about whether women are different because it's innate or because it's trained. But that's the question. When women come to the table of leadership, are they doing something different? However they came to that difference, is not our topic. The question is there something different in what they bring to the table? Or is it just exciting that the door is open and she could be the best man for the job? So as I say, I think that there are plenty of women who fit the first criterion. I'm sure there are plenty of women who fit the second one. And that's the one we really want to talk about today.
There's that quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I have a little book of quotes that I purchased at the Jewish Museum in Philadelphia. Someone asked her, you know, like, how many women do you want to see on the Supreme Court? Like, how many is enough? And she's like, 9, because there have been 9 men. So why shouldn't there be 9 women? When it's not a big deal, when you're not asking the question of how many women should be on a committee, then we'll know we've got there, right? Not that she felt like all women have to, that the Supreme Court has to be full of women, but it's more like that question should be moot. So it's an interesting, it just adds kind of a context to, like, you know, what, especially, by the way, hello, Vice President of the United States of America is a female, a woman of color. You know, I hate hearing when people say, well, she's only there because Joe said he was gonna, you know, put in a woman. So like anyone in heels would do. I use that instead of a different thing to say. But is that what we're saying? Like, you know, do we have to degrade women who get up there? Like, when are women just going to be people? Is my question.
So I think, at least in these two cases, and I want to make the disclaimer that we're not talking politics here. Right? No. We're not talking about when labor, voting labor is a very different thing than being pleased that the Labour Party had the gumption to vote in a woman as leader. I would say the same thing. I think that we have spoken publicly on the podcast about our Chochmat Hashim collective views about the previous administration. So that's not a secret, but it's also not the point here. The point is not about, do you like Kamala Harris or the Biden administration? The point is that this glass ceiling has been broken. And I do think, Shoshana, that in these two cases, both Mirav Mikhaeli and Kamala Harris, we are talking about people who are qualified, and there is no affirmative action going on here. It is not because, oh, she's female, so let's accommodate that. Mm-hmm. I am sure that there are many considerations going into how a president chooses a vice president, a running mate.
One would hope.
But yes, but the first order of business has to be, is this person going to be competent in the job? And Kamala Harris ran for president. She didn't make it through the primaries. She stepped out, but she's been a senator. She's been in roles of leadership professionally for many years. The fact that people might disagree with her or might not want her for president or might not vote for her for president directly does not undermine her accomplishment as a female leader, a woman of color, and in her role as Joe has chosen her to be the vice president, which puts her, of course, a step away. Right? Like, we don't want to think about that. Joe should live out his term beautifully, la da la da. Right? Meaning, my point is just that this is not kowtowing to the electorate. Let's get a woman to be my running mate so I can get the votes. I hope he got some votes for her sake. But if she weren't competent, I wouldn't want her as vice president.
Look, I definitely think in this specific case, did he want to say, if I can find, you know, if there's two people, one male, one female, who are competent, I'm going to go female. I definitely think that was a consideration for him. I definitely think, because that's part of his ideology, right?
Sure.
But if she wasn't competent, he wouldn't have chosen her, right? So there's no reason to ask these stupid questions about whether she's competent or not in that regard, whether you like her politics or not, as you said. But what's interesting is that one of the articles that I was reading that you suggested that I read spoke about the glass cliff. And this is interesting, actually, in terms of Meirav, because labor, if anyone's following, has been taking a nosedive. Like, it's sad that this party that really helped build the country is now down to something like 4 seats expected in this election.
No, which is Shoshana, lowest. It's worse than that. Without Meirav Mikhaeli at the helm, they were not expected to make the threshold to get into the Knesset. Her election has shifted the tables quite literally. Mm-hmm. So again, there we can say that's not affirmative action. She turned everything around. She got 77% of the, I guess, of the voting labor members.
Primary.
Right? In the primary, it's only the people in the Labour Party who are voting for her to be the leader. And basically, she won hands down. It's, right. You know, 77% is insane numbers in an Israeli election, right? So even in a primary. So yeah, she is fully competent. Again,
I wonder, and I haven't followed it enough. But as we're talking about it, like, I wonder, like, if the men bailed, because Peretz bailed, and the other guy, I forgot his name, bailed. And I'm wondering if they bailed because either they realize she's more competent than I am, which would be the best case scenario, right? Like, you know what? I'm going to step aside. This person is better than me in this role. Or if they were like, if this doesn't go well, I don't want to have my name associated with it. And that was, don't really, because that was one of the things that we were reading about this glass cliff, which is that things get really, really bad. They bring a woman on. And then when she can't save the Titanic,
it's all her fault.
Exactly. First of all, I've never heard of it until I read this, and that's a shame. But it has a lot of statistics and things for anyone who wants to go and read this article. I'll add it to the description on our website of the podcast.
Let's just note it's from the Harvard Business Review. Research, women are better leaders during a crisis, by Jack Zenger and Joseph Folkman from December 30th, 2020. This is recent. This is current. This is very much about the pandemic. We'll get there.
One of us went to Harvard and it wasn't me. So, yeah. So it's just this interesting thing. It says when discussing the careers of women leaders, there's a phenomenon referred to as the glass cliff. It's an obvious relative to the term glass ceiling, which describes an invisible barrier, blah, blah, blah. The glass cliff describes the idea that when a company's in trouble, a female leader is put in charge to save it. When women are finally given a chance to prove themselves in a senior position, they're handed something that's broken and where the chances of failure are high. And this goes on and on, and you'll talk more about this academic stuff, but that makes me so angry and frustrated. You know, it's like, really? We get there, and finally when we get there, it's like, here's the Titanic. It's all interplays into this whole thing. But I will just say, and then I'll hand it over to you, that I am pleased to see women in positions of influence and power. We talk about it all the time, why every community, society, country needs perspectives of both men and women. I don't believe that women need to replace men, but I do believe women absolutely need to be high up there and of influence.
So I'm going to talk about another article. This is from September 24th, 2020. It's a little bit longer ago. Quote, six things we can learn from how women leaders have handled the pandemic. So here we're going to talk about the pandemic, but we're also talking about leadership. I should say that part of what happens is that because women are new to these positions, there is less tying them to the what has always been done. And that is helpful sometimes, mm-hmm. especially when you're encountering something that is new and terrible, right? New and great. I would hope everybody would succeed no matter what they do. But new and terrible requires a whole new thinking out of the box, which is less thinking out of the box for women because they were never in the box. So they don't mm-hmm. have to jump out of it. They're just in the role and looking around and saying, now, what do we do? So this article, it's on ideas.ted.com, has basically these six major takeaways from what the women in leadership actually did, meaning not prescribing what one should do, but looking at these women and say, what did they do? These women in leadership who handled or have been handling, since it's ongoing, have been handling the pandemic in ways that seem to have been more successful. Number one, include everyone, meaning the very fact that you can open that table, you can bring people in to exert their own expertise is part of the story. And this happened, I think, in Norway. Erna Solberg, the Norwegian prime minister, would have coronavirus instructional events for children to ease their fears. Now, that sounds like such a small thing. They're not even voting for her, right? They're too young. But the idea is that when you're talking about caring for a population and you are that leader, the very idea that you can then bring everyone into the fold, I don't think it has to be women. Let's be clear here. They do not have to be women to do this. It's simply good leadership, sure. But it does seem to have emerged from the women's handling, the various female leaders across the world, the women's handling of the pandemic. Number two, be authentic. This is not something we're ever going to argue with. The fact that the pandemic really, it's affected everybody in all kinds of ways, right? So when the New Zealand Prime Minister, who is known for New Zealand's handling, has been remarkable, right? Jacinda Ardern. So what does she do? She hosts a Facebook Live and she was dressed casually and she's talking from her house and everybody knows that everybody is at home in Zoom. Sometimes people dress formally on the top, casually on the bottom. And sometimes people are in sweatpants the whole time or in their pajamas the whole time, right? Meaning business attire has changed at the very least while on Zoom. But you don't necessarily expect that from your prime minister. So when the New Zealand prime minister hosts Facebook Live from her own home, and she's wearing sweatpants, and she's talking about, you know, putting her toddlers to bed. Now, everybody is in this together in a different kind of way. And Shoshana, we're talking about what does it mean to have social responsibility and make sure that everybody's wearing a mask? Well, when you have that from the top,
modeling
trickles down, like it's not incidental. Again, this doesn't have to be a female doing it. It happens to be that she was female. And lo and behold, so many of these tips are coming from women leaders. Number three, and I do love this. Number three, tell the truth. I mean, that should be an easy one, but sometimes, especially in politics, it's not necessarily so easy. This is Germany. Angela Merkel, the first thing she did was, and she's a scientist, right? She's a biologist, I think. She laid forth the statistics and the data before everybody. She explained the epidemiological models and why they were doing what they were doing. And so part of that is being upfront. It's not just avoiding a lie. It's being forthcoming, giving people more information to be able to participate. And so I think that this is a running theme here in terms of inclusion and getting people involved and getting people to feel responsible. I don't know that this article actually links them. These are six distinct points. But I'm linking them here. Number four, and this is one that I think many people would say, what, women? Number four, be decisive. Now, obviously, leadership requires decision-making. So this is the example of Taiwan, and Taiwan might have handled the pandemic perhaps better than anywhere else, in part because they were already wearing masks, because they'd already experienced SARS, meaning in the terrible SARS from a couple of years ago. So she, boom, like went at it, made decisions and made strides for the government to require certain things of the population and to make sure that the pandemic was in hand. And Taiwan, as far as I know, has lost fewer people than any other comparably sized country, meaning obviously there's little islands in places that haven't seen the coronavirus, but that's not in our bailiwick right now. And the article here makes the point that just because you're being decisive doesn't mean that you're doing it all yourself. The fact that you can make a decision having first collected information and wisdom from organizations and from scientists and a whole range of experts, now you have to be, you the leader, have to go and make the decision to go forward. Everything has to come to you to make that decision and go forward. But you can bring in all the help you need to get you to the position with enough information to be able to make a sound decision. Number five, and this perhaps is specific to our era, embrace technology. So that in Iceland, not a country we hear so much about so often, in Iceland, and I don't think I'm going to be able to pronounce her name, Katrín Jakobst...
I'm sorry.
J-A-K-O-B-S-D. Oh, with an accent on top of it. What's an accent doing there? T-T-I-R. Icelandic is very hard. It's a very hard, very long language. They had intensive screening and tracking, which people I know in the US have been frustrated. People in Israel, for that matter, where they did have governmental tracking at a certain point, have been frustrated that that did not continue. It makes it much harder to figure out how did you get it, how to prevent the next person from getting it. And yet in Iceland, again, a small country, sure, they've implemented it right away. And they have double testing and a mandatory quarantine for travelers, meaning all of that is from a contact tracing app. In Iceland, they had screening and tracking, and in Finland, they had a contact tracing app. And again, you're using the tools at your disposal to conquer this, you know, very tiny, very deadly enemy. And lastly, and I think this is, of course, the key point, our key point from this whole experience, is that namely leaders of every kind can learn from these women, right? You don't have to be a country. You don't have to be facing a pandemic. These are not unique traits to this specific, maybe the contact tracing is specific, but in terms of being able to maximize your use of all different kinds of resources and involving all the people that you could possibly, like all of these points, everything that I've just read and said and listed, they're all applicable to other circumstances. This is leadership. I'm not saying this is all there is to good leadership. It is all good leadership, and it happens to be, or maybe specifically is, all from women.
That's really very fascinating. And I'm always loath when people, like I see these articles that say, oh, women have done better than men. Like I don't like it in general because I think it just causes, the approach is hard. At the same time, you're right in what you said about how like there's not a lot of need to do what I've done before fall back on that. You know, there's so bringing new things, bringing different perspectives already makes such a difference in the way that you're going to tackle things. Thinking about comforting the people who are your people and being in jeans and a t-shirt and doing a Zoom, these, you want to say they're maternal things, you want to say they're emotional things, you want to say that they're, you know, some people are happy with that stuff, some people are not, and I totally am fine either way. At the same time, it's important to learn from everyone. It's important to recognize that anyone could be a good leader and that we need more people, more women, more people with different experiences to come in and be part of leading a society. And at the same time, while women are leading and doing wonderful things and gaining, we also know that this pandemic has brought out a tremendous discrepancy and disparity in how women are able to continue to work. And the labor and the work that they have to catch up with at home, now with the kids at home, now with having to work from home, now having a limited space, time, energy, and ability. And what's happening to the female workforce, even as some women are doing such a great job in leadership?
Yeah, this is also very current, very hot topic. Time Magazine had an article about this. Again, one of many, many in the past several months, more than that. I think even last May, they were already talking about the fact that the women were paying the price more so than men in terms of the cost of their jobs. That's partially because of the jobs that tend to be held by women. And it's also, of course, related to who's most likely to stay home for childcare. So here's the headline from Time Magazine. Women have lost a disproportionate number of jobs due to COVID-19. Here's how we can start to fix a broken system. So you can all go read the article, meaning that's not hard to find. But the idea is that in the last month, meaning this is an article dated January 25th, in the last month, just recently, America lost a whopping 140,000 jobs. 140,000 jobs is a lot of jobs. And women accounted for all of them, all of them.
Wow.
That's not the same thing as saying, well, there's a preponderance or it's affecting women worse, meaning this is a dramatic difference. And some of that is because of, again, if you're a teacher and there's no school, then that's a whole different ballgame than, I don't know, if you're an executive. So there are obviously women who are still in their positions of power, whatever, positions of leadership. The higher you are in the corporate ladder, the more likely you are to still have your job, whatever gender you are, is going to be less have less of an impact. But working from home is a challenge. The glass ceiling that has been broken in so many fields for so long now, meaning it's, we can take it as a given, Shoshana. Until a year ago, I would say, we were taking it as a given that women would be in certain positions of all different kinds of professions. And now suddenly we're seeing not exactly a reimposition of a glass ceiling, but just default, like it's just happening that women are falling behind in their various professions, in part, because of the pandemic. It's not because of working from home. It's because of what does it mean to work from home? If both husband and wife are working from home and you have clamoring for attention and need it, right? Which parent, and this
always
is statistical, right? It's statistical.
Always.
It's not, we're making generalizations, but we know.
No,
right?
I keep seeing this over and over and over again in my Facebook groups, my mommy Facebook groups, whatever you want to say, or working women's Facebook groups, actually, where women are saying, I don't understand. I'm home working. My husband is home working. The child's closer to my husband. I'm behind a closed door on my computer. The child will come to me. My phone is ringing. My computer is dinging for my child looking for me and not to my husband. To the point where one woman actually was in tears. She's posted and she said, I made them lunches. I wrote them notes. I told them exactly where everything was and I handed the schedule to my husband. And still, they keep coming and banging on my door and I don't know what to do. I can't do anything more to make them okay with me, either without me or with my husband. And yet they still keep coming to me and she didn't know what to do. She was mortified. And I just want to say one more thing. Reading these articles, it was sad to me how the women were describing how being a mom or being a potential mother was a real detriment to either an interview or a job themselves. Like if they spoke about the fact that they have kids, or they spoke about, or they didn't want to tell people that they had kids, because it's automatically either you're an excellent worker and you work all the time and you're always available, or you're a good mom You can't be both, right? There's no way that you can be.
This is what I was going to say. Women have been working moms now for a good many decades, and a lot of women have conquered it. They have figured out how to manage juggling job and family. Career, I don't just mean a job, right? Career and family. And they have been very successful at it. People will, you know, say, okay, we'll let the house cleaning go. We'll hire somebody to help with the thus and such. It doesn't matter what. People have figured it out in a way that was not the case, let's say 30 years ago or 50 years ago or however long ago it was. And now that's no longer in place.
Apart. Right?
The juggling that requires so much energy and so much attention to detail, and it takes a great deal out of women. That's why there are working mother Facebook groups to begin with.
Exactly. Right?
There's a need for the support that goes into that, but they're doing it. And now they're not doing it. Some are, but in the
it's taking a tremendous toll. It's taking a tremendous toll. I feel for my friends, colleagues here and in America who are just buckling under the pressure of taking care of the kids, keeping the house, working somehow under the kids while the husband is, it's just assumed that if anyone's going to suffer from this, she's going to take more burden. And single moms, single parents, I should say, like, oh my gosh.
So I think the real question here is what happens next? Because at this point, we're in the pandemic. Women's jobs have taken a toll. Women's careers have taken a toll. Families are taking, everybody's taking a toll in so many different directions. I think the challenge is going to be to cross this year off, to call it a time out, to not hold it against women who might have lost ground in their career trajectory because of this year. I don't know how we're going to convince the whole world to call this a pause, but I feel like that's going to be the challenge, to make sure that the same people who are really accomplished and thriving in their jobs will be able to pick that up again, you know, if they want to, when that time comes.
Maybe our leaders, our female leaders or male leaders, can help with that. I know my sister sent me something this morning and I sent it to you. I just want to pull it up real quick. I think it's Girls Who Code is who put this up, took out a full page ad in the New York Times calling on the Biden administration to support moms by implementing a Marshall Plan for Moms. In the first 100 days, 50 prominent women signed onto the letter. And it's basically calling for a Marshall Plan for moms. Marshall Plan was when America, I believe, gave $12 billion to Western Europe to help them after the war to rebuild. And they're basically saying, COVID has decimated so many of our careers. 2 million of us have left the workforce at the rate of 4 times that of men in September alone. Millions more have been forced to cut back hours or work around the clock to keep our jobs and be full-time caregivers. It's not isolated. It's a national crisis. You didn't create the problem, but you can fix it or help fix it. Establish a task force to create a Marshall Plan for moms. Implement a short-term monthly payment to moms depending on needs and resources. Pass long overdue policies like paid family leave, affordable childcare, and pay equity. And so what I'm saying is that maybe we can do better than calling this year a wash, but rather learning from it and recognizing the importance of parenting and of raising the next generation and not make it a bad thing. Like in Israel, professors show up with kids. Like it happens here so often that your kid will be, and it's okay. It's so much more family friendly here. And I think America could do with a little bit more of chill and being happy and okay with family and letting a little bit of that, you know, maybe we can learn from it and grow from it. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. And now we come to our final segment, the dish to dish. Shoshana.
Oh, mine's a little heavy of a dish. As I mentioned earlier, today's International Holocaust Memorial Day, and I know it won't be when you guys are listening to this, but I would be remiss if I didn't say, take a minute, read a story, learn from some. You can read my grandparents' story, listen to a survivor or a survivor's child and share that story with yourself, with your friends, with your kids, because the way we do better is by remembering and never forgetting and sharing those personal stories.
Oh boy, I don't think I can follow that. So I just want to say as follows. I watched, and again, I don't want to be in the politics of this, but I watched the inauguration in the US, meaning on the computer. I actually had two different links going so that I could hear the commentary from one and watch the pageantry from the other. And first of all, there's just something very lovely about what I'll call here the pageantry and, you know, who's wearing what and the colors and they announce who's coming in. And I realized that I know more of these figures than I might have once known. And I don't think I ever saw an inauguration before. Maybe I heard some of the speeches on the radio at the time, It also is the time zone, meaning usually it's in the middle of the day in America, but it was evening here. And I watched it with my son, who's going on 7, meaning he's little. And he was also watching with enthusiasm for the pageantry of this. And here's where I said, oh, I am so proud of that dual citizenship. I'm so proud to, as much as I'm proud to be, maybe not as much, but in the same zone that I'm proud to be an Israeli, I'm proud to be an American. And part of where it hit me was in seeing the Republicans who have fought the entirety of this, the past 4 years, you know, everything, and the election process and the post-election process and so on. And I understand that not everybody was there, but there were many Republicans who are senior leadership in the Republican Party who were there, and they were wearing masks and they were shaking mm-hmm. hands or bumping elbows or whatever you do in the Corona era. And they were participating in the inauguration of the next president of the United States. And yes, his cabinet is to be diverse. And yes, he's got a woman and a woman of color and all of this on his, you know, and there's so many things that we could get into the politics, and it's probably a worthy discussion for another time, but that's not the point. My point to me was, this was, in fact, despite all fears to the contrary, a peaceful transfer of power, democracy at work, and I was really glad to see it.
And your dish is beautiful, and I'm going to add to your dish by saying that anyone who has not seen Amanda Gorman's poetry reading from the inauguration should go and see it, because I was also privileged to watch the inauguration with my boys. My older one left in the middle, but my younger one sat on my lap and watched the whole poetry reading. It was glorious and beautiful and inspiring and just what America needed. She was eloquent and hopeful and inspirational and not bitter or angry. She was the opposite of divisive. She was very unifying and absolutely talented. So if you haven't seen it or read it, please do. It is absolutely beautiful, and can't recommend that enough.
Thank you for joining us. That's our episode for the day. Come talk to us on our Facebook page. Tell us what you think. What do you think about women in the workforce? How has the pandemic affected you? Do you agree with us about the role of women in leadership? Besides wanting women in leadership, do you think that women have something different to offer by joining the table, right? The seat at the table. Everybody should have a seat at the table. We're appreciating diversity, and we want to hear what you think in this same quest for different voices. Our Facebook page, CHOCHMATNASHIM.
Can you hear us now?